C.H. Spurgeon's Autobiography, Chapter 3, being read by Peter John Parises, also known as Brian Dean. Happy Childhood at Stamboni. The Old Manse and Meeting House, Stamboni. Oh, the old house at home. Who does not love it, the place of our childhood, the old roof tree, the old cottage? There is no other village in all the world half so good as that particular village. True, the gates, the stiles, the posts have been altered, but still there is an attachment to those old houses, the old tree in the park and the old ivory mantled tower. It is not very picturesque, perhaps, but we love to go to see it. We like to see the haunts of our boyhood. There is something pleasant in those old stairs where the clock used to stand, and in the room where grandmother was wont to bend her knee, and where we had family prayer. There is no place like that house, after all. CHS. This drawing of the old manse and Stamboni has far more charms for me than for any of my readers, but I hope that their generous kindness to the writer will cause them to be interested in it. Here, my venerable grandfather lived for more than 50 years and reared his rather numerous family. In its early days, it must have been a very remarkable abode for a dissenting teacher, a clear evidence that either he had an estate of his own or that those about him had large hearts and pockets. It was in all respects a gentleman's mansion of the olden times. The house had been supplanted by one which I doubt not is most acceptable to the excellent minister who occupies it, but to me it can never be one half so dear as the revered old home in which I spent some of my earliest years. It is true the old parsonage had developed devotional tendencies and seemed inclined to prostrate its venerable form, and therefore it might have fallen down of itself if it had not been removed by the builder. But, somehow, I wish it had kept up forever and ever. I could have cried, "Builders, spare that home. Touch not a single tile or bit of plaster." But its hour was come, and so the earthly house was happily dissolved, to be succeeded by a far more enduring fabric. A new house, as Smith told me, was built on the same destruction. It stood near the chapel so that the pastor was close to his work. It looks a very noble parsonage with its 8 windows in front, but at least 3, and I think 4, of these were plastered up and painted black, and then marked out in lines to imitate glass. They were not such very bad counterfeits, or the photograph would betray this. Some of us can remember the window tacks, which seemed to regard light as a Latin commodity, lux, and therefore a luxury, and as such to be taxed. So much was paid on each aperture for the admission of light, but the minister's small income forced economy upon him. And so room after room of the manse was left in darkness to be regarded by my childish mind with reverent awe. Over other windows were put up boards marked dairy or cheese room, because by being labeled with these names, they would escape the tribune. What a queer mind must his have been, who first invented taxing the light of the sun. It was no doubt meant to be a fair way of estimating the size of a house, and thus getting at the wealth of the inhabitant. But, incidentally, it led occupiers of large houses to shut out the light for which they were too poor to pay. Let us enter by the front door. We stepped into a spacious hall, innocent of carpet. There is a great fireplace over it, a painting of David, and the Philistines, and giant Goliath. The hall floor was a brick carefully sprinkled with fresh sand. We see this in the country still, but not often in the minister's house. In the hall stood the child's rocking chair. It was a gray horse and could be ridden astride or side-saddled. When I visited Stan Borney in the year 1889, a man claimed to have rocked me upon it. I remembered the horse, but not the man. So sadly did we forget the better and remember the baser. This was the only horse that I ever enjoyed riding. Living animals are too eccentric in their movements, and the law of gravitation usually draws me from my seat upon them to a lower level. Therefore, I am not an inveterable lover of horseback. I can, however, testify of my Stan Borney stead that it was a horse on which even a member of Parliament might have retained his seat. I used to delight to stand in the hall and with the door open and watch the rain run off the top of the door into the washtub. How much better to catch the overflow of the rain in a tub than to have a gutter to carry it off, so I thought, but do not now think. What boats to float, cotton reels in the miniature sea. How fresh and sweet that rain seems to be. The fragrancy of the water which poured down in a thunderous shower comes over me now. Where the window is open on the right was the best parlor. Roses generally grew about it and bloomed in the room if they could find means to insert their buds between the wall and the window frame. They generally found ample space, for nothing was quite on the square. There had evidently been a cleaning up just before my photograph was taken, for there were no roses creeping up from below. What vandals people are when they set about clearing up either the outside or the inside of houses. On the sacred walls of this best parlor hung portraits of my grandparents and uncles, and on a piece of furniture stood the fine large basin which grandfather used for what he called baptisms. In my heart of hearts, I believe it was originally intended for a punch bowl, but in any case, it was a work of art, worthy of the use to which it was dedicated. This is the room which contained the marble to which I have often referred, an apple in a bottle. I remember well, in my early days, seeing upon my grandmother's mantel shelf an apple contained in a large, thin bottle. This was a great wonder to me, and I tried to investigate it. My question was, how came the apple to get inside so small a bottle? The apple was quite as big round as the bottle. But what means was it placed within? Though it was treason to touch the treasures on the mantel place, I took down the bottle and convinced my youthful mind that the apple never passed through its neck, and by means of an attempt to unscrew the bottom, I became equally certain that the apple did not enter from below. I held to the notion that by some occult means the bottle had been made in two pieces and afterwards united in so careful a manner that no traces of the joint remain. I was hardly satisfied with the theory, but as no philosopher was at hand to suggest other hypotheses, I let the matter rest. One day, the next summer, I chanced to see upon a bluff another large bottle, Phial, the first cousin of my old friend, within which was growing a little apple, which had been placed through the neck of the bottle while it was extremely small. Quote, nature well known, no prodigies remain, end quote. The grand secret was out. I did not cry, Eureka, Eureka, but I might have done so if I had then been versed in the Greek tongue. This discovery of my juvenile days shall serve for an illustration at the present moment. Let us get the apples into the bottle while they are little. While being translated signifies, let us bring the young ones into the house of God by means of the Sabbath school in the hope that, in after days, they will love the place where his honor dwelleth, and there he can find eternal life. By our making the Sabbath dreary, many young minds may be prejudiced against religion. We would do the reverse. Sermons should not be so long and dull as to weary the young folk, or mischief will come of them. but with interesting preaching to secure attention and loving teachers to press home the truth upon the youthful heart. We shall not have to complain of the next generation that they have, quote, forgotten their resting places, end quote. In this best parlor, Grandfather would usually sit on Sunday mornings and prepare himself for preaching. I was put into the room with him that I might be quiet, and as a rule, the evangelical magazine was given me. This contained a portrait of a revered divine and one picture of a mission station. Grandfather often requested me to be quiet and always gave as a reason that I, quote, had the magazine, unquote. I did not at the time perceive the full force of the argument to be derived from that fact. But no doubt my venerable relative knew more about the sedative effect of a magazine than I did. I cannot support his opinion from personal experience. Another means of stifling the child was much more effectual. I was warned that perhaps Grandpa would not be able to preach if I distracted him. And then, then, what would happen if poor people did not learn the way to heaven? This made me look at the portrait and the missionary station once more. Little did I dream that some other child would one day see my face in that wonderful evangelical portrait gallery. When I was a very small boy, I was allowed to read the scriptures at family prayer. Once upon a time, in reading the passage in Revelations which mentions the bottomless pit, I paused and said, Grandpa, what can this mean? The answer was kind, but unsatisfactory. Poor, poor child, go on. The child, however, intended to have an explanation, and therefore selected the same chapter morning after morning, and always halted at the same verse to repeat the inquiry, hoping that by repetition he would importunate the good old gentleman into a reply. The process was successful, for it is by no means the most edifying thing in the world to hear the history of the mother of harlots and the beast with seven heads every morning in the week, Sunday included, with no sort of alteration either of psalms or gospel. The venerable patronage of the household therefore capitulated at discretion with, well, dear, what is it that puzzles you? Now the child had often seen baskets with but very frail bottoms, which in course of wear became bottomless and allowed the fruit passed therein to drop upon the ground. Here then was the puzzle. If the pit aforesaid had no bottom, where would all those people fall to whom dropped out of its lower end? A puzzle which rather startled the proprietary of family worship and had to be laid aside for explanation at some more convenient time. Queries of the like simple but rather unusual stamp would frequently break up into paragraphs of miscellaneous length, the Bible reading of the assembled family, and had there not been a world of law and license allowed to the inquisitive reader, he would very soon have been deposed from his office. As it was, the scriptures were not very badly rendered, and were probably quite as interesting as if they had not been interspersed with original and curious inquiries. I can remember the horror of my mind when my dear grandfather told me what his idea of the bottomless pit was. There is a deep pit, and the soul is falling down. Oh, how fast it is falling! There, the last ray of light at the top has disappeared, and it falls on, and so it goes on falling, on, for 1,000 years. Is it not getting near the bottom yet? Won't it stop? No, no, the cry is, no, no, on and on. I have been falling 1,000,000 years. Am I near the bottom yet? No, you are no near the bottom yet. It is the bottomless pit. It is on, and so the soul goes on falling perpetually into a deeper depth still, falling forever into the bottomless pit, on, into the pit that has no bottom. Woe without termination, without hope of its coming to a conclusion. In my grandfather's garden, there was a fine old hedge of yew, that's Y-E-W, of considerable length, which was clipped and trimmed till it made quite a wall of verdure, V-E-R-D-U-R-E. Behind it was a wide grass walk, which looked upon the fields. The grass was kept mowed so as to make pleasant walking. Here, ever since the old Puritanic chapel was built, godly divines had walked and prayed and meditated. My grandfather was wont to use it as his study. Up and down he would walk when preparing his sermons, and always on Sabbath days when it was fair. He had half an hour there before preaching. To me, it seemed to be a perfect paradise, and being forbidden to stay there when grandfather was meditating, I viewed it with no small degree of awe. I loved to think of the green and quiet walk at this moment, but I was once shocked and even horrified by hearing a farmer man remark concerning the sanctum, it ought grow a many tartars if it won't plow up. What cared he for holy memories? What were meditations and contemplations to him? Is it not the chief end of man to grow potatoes and eat them? Such on a larger scale would be an unconverted man's estimate of joys, so elevated and refined as those of heaven. Mr. Carr tells a story of a servant's man who called his master to be allowed to leave his cottage and sleep over at the stable. What was the matter with his cottage? Why, sir, the nightingales all around the cottage make such a junk, junk, junk at night that I cannot bear them. A man with a musical ear would be charmed with nightingales' song. But here was a man without a musical soul who found the sweetest notes a nuisance. This is a feeble image of the incapacity of unregenerated man for the enjoyment of the world to come, and as he is capable of enjoying them, so is he incapable of longing for them. While my grandfather was preacher at the meeting house, Mr. Hopkins was rector at the church. They preached the same gospel, and without surrendering their principles, were great friends. The Bible Society held its meetings alternately in connection with the church and meeting house. At times, the leading resident went to church in the morning and to chapel in the afternoon. And when I was a boy, I have on Monday gone to the squares to tea with Mr. Hopkins and my grandfather. The glory of that tea party was that we four, the three old gentlemen and the little boy, all ate sugar bread and butter together for a treat. The sugar was very brown, but the young boy was very pleased, and the old boys were merry also. Yes, Stamboni had its choice pleasures. It is pleasant to read of the harmony between those two men of God. They increased in mutual esteem as they increased in years. As Mr. Hopkins had more of the meat, and Mr. Spurgeon more of the mouths, the rector did not forget to help his friend in divers quiet ways, such as a 5-pound note for a sick daughter to go to the seaside, and presents of comforts in illness. On one occasion, it is said that having a joint of beef on the rector's table, the clergyman cut it in halves and sent his man on horseback with one half of it to the independent parsonage while it was yet hot, a kind of joke not often practiced between established and dissenting ministers. In the front of the house, towards the left, nearly hidden by a shrub, is a very important window, for it let light into the room wherein were the oven, the mangle, and the best of all, the kneading troughs. How often have I gone to that kneading trough, for it had a little shelf in it, and there would be placed something for the child. A bit of pastry, which was culled by me, according to its size, a pig or a rabbit, which had ears and currants for eyes, was carefully placed in that shrine like the manna in the ark. Dear grandmother, how much you labored to spoil that child. Yet your memory is more dear to him than that of wiser folks who did not spoil the child. Do you now look down from your mansion above upon your petted grandson? Do you feel as if he would have been better if you had been sour in heart, not a bit of it. Aunt Anne, who had a finger in it all, would spoil the child again if she had a chance. I had put in such an approach to a portrait of my grandmother as I can find. It was taken by some traveling artist who visited the district and took off several of the family. The diary at the back of the house was by no means a bad place for a cheesecake or a drink of cool milk. It makes one think of the hymn. I have been there and still would go. The cupboard under the stairs, where they kept the sand for the floors, would be a real old curious shop nowadays, but there it was, and great was the use of it in the cottagers around. There was a sitting floor in the room at the back of the house where the family met for meals. In that which looks like a blank side in our picture there certainly was a window looking out upon the garden. Perhaps it was a little further back than the picture goes. A very pleasant outlook there was from that window down the green garden path and over the hedge into the road. When I last saw the keeping room, a bit of ivy had forced its way through the lath and plaster and had been trained along the inside of the room. But in my childish days, we were not so verdant. I remember a mark on the paper which had been made by the finger of one of my uncles. So they told me when one year the flour was so bad that it turned into a paste or pudding inside the loaf and could not be properly made into bread. History has been learned from handwritings on the wall. The times of the old Napoleon Wars and of corn laws must often have brought straightness of bread into the household, and a failure in the yield of the little farm made itself felt in the family. There was a mysterious jack over the fireplace, and with that fireplace itself I was very familiar, for candles were never used extravagantly in grandfather's house, and if anyone went out of the room and took the candle with him, it was just a little darker, not very much, and if one wished to read, the firelight was the only resort. There were mold candles now and then in the best room, but that was only on very high days and holidays. My opinion, derived from personal observation, was that all everyday candles were made of rushes and tallows. Our young readers in London and other large towns have probably never seen a pair of snuffers, much less the flint and steel, with which a light had to be painfully obtained by the help of a tinderbox and brimstone match. What a job on a cold, raw morning to strike and strike and see the sparks die out because the tinder was damp. We are indeed living in an age of light when we compare our incandescent gas burners and electric lights with the rush lights of our childhood. And yet the change is not all one way. For if we have more light, we have also more fog and smoke, at least in London. Our keeping room was a very nice, large, comfortable dining room, and it had a large store closet at one end. You should have seen the best china. It only came out on state occasions, but it was very marvelous in the child's eye. A quaint old winding stair led to the upper chambers. The last time I occupied the best bedroom, the floor appeared anxious to go out of the window. At least it inclined that way. There seemed to be a chirping of birds very near my pillow in the morning, and I discovered that swallows had built outside the plaster, and sparrows had found a hole which admitted them inside of it, that there they may lay their young. It is not always that one can lay in bed and study the birds. I confess that I liked all this rural life and the old bedroom furniture and the paper round and the looking glass cut in the form of a horse chestnut leaves and daffodils and the Tuileries old mansions altogether. The boy among the books. I am afraid I am amusing myself rather than my reader, and so I will not weary him with more than this one bit more of rigmarole just now. But there was one place upstairs which I cannot omit even at the risk of being wearisome. Opening out of one of the bedrooms, there was a little chamber, of which the window had been blocked up through that wretched window duty. When the original founder of Stamboni Meeting quitted the Church of England to form a separate congregation, he would seem to have been in possession of a fair estate, and the house was quite a noble one for those times. Before the lighting excluding tax had come into operation, that little room was the minister's study and closet for prayer, and a very nice, cozy room, too. In my time, it was a dark den, but it contained books, and this made it a gold mine to me. Therein was fulfilled the promise, quote, I will give thee the treasures of darkness, unquote. Some of these were enormous folios, such as a boy could hardly lift. Here I first struck up acquaintance with the martyrs, especially with old Bonner, who burned them, next with Bunyan and his pilgrim, and further on with the great masters of scriptural theology, with whom no modern are worthy to be named in the same day. Even the old editions of their works, with their margins and old-fashioned notes, are precious to me. It is easy to tell a real Puritan book, even by its shape and by the appearance of the type. I confess that I harbor a prejudice against nearly all new editions and cultivate a preference for the originals, even though they wander about in sheepskins and goatskins and are shut up in the hardest of boards. It made my eyes water a short time ago to see a number of those old books in the new mansion. I wonder whether some other boy will love them and live to revive that grand old divinity which will yet be to England her balm and bensign. Out of that darkened room I fetched those old authors when I was yet a youth, and never was I happier than when in their company. Out of the present contempt into which Puritanism has fallen, many brave hearts and truth will fetch it. By the help of God, ere many years have passed, those who have dolted up the windows will yet be surprised to see heaven's light beaming on the old truth, and then breaking forth from it to their own confusion. The following incident in Mr. Spurgeon's childhood days is here given as it was related by his Aunt Anne, and on occasion when he visited Stamboni in the summer of 1887. One of the members of the church of Stamboni, named Rhodes, was in the habit of frequenting the public house to have his drop of beer and smoke his pipe, greatly to the grief of his godly pastor, who often heaved a sigh at the thought of his unhappy member's inconsistent conduct. Little Charles had doubtless noticed his grandfather's grief on this occasion and laid it to heart. One day, he suddenly exclaimed, in the hearing of the good old man, I'll kill old Rhodes, that I will. Hush, hush, my dear, said the good pastor. You mustn't talk so. It's very wrong, you know, and you'll get taken up by the police if you do anything wrong. I shall not do anything bad, but I'll kill him, though, that I will. Well, the good old grandfather was puzzled, but yet perfectly sure that the child would not do anything which he knew to be wrong. So he let it pass with some half-mental remark about that strange child. Shortly after, however, the above conversation was brought to his mind by the child coming in and saying, I've killed old Rhodes. He'll never grieve my dear grandpa anymore. My dear child, said the good man, what have you done? Where have you been? I haven't been doing any harm, grandpa, said the child, I've been about the Lord's work, that's all. Nothing more could be elicited from little Charles. But before long, the mystery was cleared up. Old Rhodes called to see his pastor, and with his downcast looks and evident sorrow of heart, narrated a story of how he had been killed, somewhat in this fashion. I am very sorry indeed, my dear pastor, to have caused you such grief and trouble. It was very wrong, I know, but I always loved you and wouldn't have done it if I'd only thought. Encouraged by the good pastor's kindly Christian words, he went on with the story. I was sitting in the public just having my pipe and a mug of beer when that child comes in. To think an old man like me should be took to task and reproved by a bit of a child like that. Well, he points at me with his finger, just so, and says, "What dost thou here, Elijah, sitting with the ungodly, and you, a member of a church, and breaking your pastor's heart? I'm ashamed of you. I wouldn't break my pastor's heart, I'm sure." And then he walks away. Well, I did feel angry, but I knew it was all true, and I was guilty. So I put down my pipe and did not touch my beer, but hurried away to a lonely spot and cast myself down before the Lord, confessing my sin and begging for forgiveness. And I do know and believe that the Lord in mercy pardoned me. And now I've come to ask you to forgive me. And I'll never grieve you any more, my dear pastor. It need not be said that the penitence was freely forgiven and owned a brother in the Lord, and the Lord was praised for the wonderful way in which it had all come about. The geniusness of the backslider's restoration is evident by the testimony of Mr. Holchin, the minister at Stamboni, who succeeded Mr. Spurgeon's grandfather, and who has always asserted from official records the correct way of spelling old Rhodes' name. Mr. Holchin writes, "Thomas Rhodes was one of the old men of the Table Pew, an active, lively little man, but quite illiterate. Not much about a laborer, but he kept a pony and cart and did a little buying and selling on his own account. I found him an earnest and zealous Christian, striving to be useful in every way possible to him, especially in the prayer meetings and among the young people, opening his house for Christian conversation and prayer. He only lived about 4 years of my time, and was sustained with a cheerful confidence to the end. When near death, on my taking up the Bible to read and pray with him, he said, 'I have counted the leaves, sir.' I said, 'Why? What did you do that for?' He replied, 'I never could read a word of it, and I thought I would know how many leaves there were.' This was very pathetic and revealed much. He had a good hope of him and missed him greatly."